It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this investigation and trial, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes graphic discussions of sexual assault that some people may find offensive and may be upsetting to some listeners. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. It was a muggy night in Phoenix, Arizona, March 2nd, 1963. The streets were busy outside the Paramount Theater on 2nd Avenue. A city bus screeched to a halt out front. A few cars behind it, a man watched as the theater's flashing lights reflected off the gleaming municipal metal of the passenger bus. And, like a vision, there she was, the woman. After a few weeks of stalking, he knew her well. She always boarded this bus around the same time after work on Saturday nights. She always boarded with the same man, dressed in their theater cashier uniforms. The man followed the bus at a distance. He didn't need to rush. He knew where it was headed, after all. He had done this a few times before. Marlette Avenue. And when the woman got off the bus, she got off alone, just as the man in the car knew she would. He was patient, and it was about to pay off. He nervously flicked his switchblade in and out, counting the seconds until the bus pulled away. Tonight would be the night. He was certain of it. As the woman walked off alone into the dark, the man readied himself and hit the gas. He was coming for her. How should we determine a person's guilt? Do we defer to the evidence discovered by police or the verdict reached by a jury? And what happens when the evidence and the verdict don't line up? Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson, and this is Not Guilty, a Parcast original. Each week, we look at complicated criminal cases that test the limits of innocent until proven guilty. This week, we'll follow the investigation of a series of sex crimes in Phoenix, Arizona, in the early 1960s. It all ended in the arrest of a man named Ernesto Arturo Miranda in 1963. However, his initial guilty verdict wasn't the end of the story. Next week, we'll see how Miranda's case eventually reached the Supreme Court and how his trials changed American policing forever. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. In order to protect the victim's privacy in this case, various pseudonyms were used in police investigations and in courts of law. For these episodes, we'll also be using a pseudonym for the victim. We've selected the one most commonly used in court documents, Lois Ann Jamison. Lois Ann Jamison was 18 years old in the spring of 1963. She worked at the box office of the Paramount Theater in Phoenix and commuted by bus every night to the home she shared with her older sister. Lois was a quiet young woman. She didn't have a lot of personal connections and had a learning disability. Work was the one place that belonged to her, where she could wander the back halls of the theater and slip into the projection booths where she could watch dreams writ large in her own personal safe haven. But the movie always ended, and her shift always came to a close. And on this night in particular, the showings had run later than usual. So Lois shuffled back out into the real world, full of noise and chaos and not too many friendly faces. There was a coworker of a similar age. Maybe he had a crush on her, but Lois never noticed. Every night, they boarded the same bus back toward the suburbs of Phoenix. Lois liked that he never pressured her to make their friendship anything more than it was. And for at least an hour every night after work, she did enjoy the company. But she always got off at Marlette Avenue alone. The night of March 2nd, 1963 was seemingly no different, until it was. The stop was only 5 blocks from her home at 1014 East Citrus Way, so Lois never felt uncomfortable walking alone, even at the end of her night. She did not know what and who was waiting for her. Out of the darkness, a beat-up green car zoomed straight towards Lois, as if the driver wanted to run her down. She leapt out of the way at the last second, and the car sped off, absorbed back into the night. Lois caught her breath. It must have just been an accident. Who in their right mind drives so dangerously? Lois would soon learn that this man was not in his right mind. He had been stalking her for weeks, following her home from the theater after her shift each night. And now, he was ready for her. Like Lois, the stalker's heart raced too. Then he turned into a vacant lot and cut the engine, waiting for her to come to him, finishing off the last beer of the six-pack he'd bought that night. Lois shook off the encounter with the wild driver and continued walking the 4 blocks home. As she passed by the vacant parking lot, she didn't notice the beat-up green car parked in the back corner. The stalker grabbed Lois from behind. He put his knife blade to her throat and gripped his hand across her mouth, telling her to be quiet. He wasn't going to hurt her. The stalker pushed Lois into the back seat of his car and made her lie on her stomach. He then put his weight on her back and pressed down. She could smell the alcohol on his breath. And then Lois felt the rope tugged across her legs, binding them together. The stalker held her down as he looped the rope up and around her torso, restricting her arms as well. His work was quick and efficient. Practiced. Lois tried to suppress her panic as the man got back into the front seat and began to drive. She wanted to escape, but her mind and body seemed disconnected. She couldn't move, even if she wanted to. She couldn't see out the windows, only streetlights passing far above her head, until even those disappeared. They were leaving the city behind. As Lois rattled and rolled around in the back seat, she also noted an odd sight. A thick strand of rope looped across the back of the car's front seat, much like the rope that constrained her body. Lois begged the man to let her go. It wasn't too late. This could all be made right. But he told her to shut up. He wasn't going to hurt her as long as she stayed quiet. After 20 minutes, the stalker pulled over on a vacant side street. He turned off the car. Only the small dome light provided Lois with any sight. Then the man climbed into the back seat. He untied her, but still held her down. The fear engulfed Lois completely. She had lost the fight. She was alone, and there was nothing she could do. In the early hours of March 3, 1963, this stalker raped Lois Ann Jameson. When the horror ended, Lois felt empty. The paralysis remained. The shock permeated throughout her, like a ringing in the ear. The man left Lois untied. He demanded she give him whatever money she had. Lois handed over $4. He told her to roll back onto her stomach. he was going to take her home. Lois couldn't breathe again until they made it back into the city. The man's car stopped near Marlette Avenue. He opened the back door. He asked Lois to pray for him, and then he pushed her out of the car. Coming up, the Phoenix police struggle to find a suspect in the wake of the attack. And now, back to the story. After her rapist dropped her back at Marlette Avenue in the early morning of March 3rd, 18-year-old Lois shivered and shook as she walked the remaining distance to her home, an act of unbelievable strength for a young woman often seen as so silent and distant. Once home, she collapsed into the arms of her sister, wept, and related the whole terrible truth of her night. In the early morning hours, the Phoenix Police Department arrived at the house to take Lois's statement. She described her attacker as a Mexican male, 6 feet in height, around 175 pounds. He wore a white t-shirt, blue Levi's, and black-rimmed glasses. He drove a dirty, light green sedan with brown interior. Lois also made sure to tell them about the rope that hung across the back of the front seat. It was filed as a kidnapping, rape, and robbery report. The detectives accompanied Lois to the emergency room, where doctors examined her. They came back with a report that would overly complicate the case for detectives. They found no visible marks or bruising on Lois's body. The doctors told the detectives that this was strange. If Lois had been tied up and struggled against her binds, there would be marks. But the doctor was wrong. Lois hadn't struggled against her binds. She had been too petrified with fear. Still, it placed doubt in the detectives' minds. But then a report came in that pointed toward a likely suspect. In the early morning hours of March 3rd, police had pursued a reckless driver. The driver crashed into a pole and then tried to flee from the officers, but he was so drunk he fell over. He matched Lois's suspect report to a T, 6 feet tall, 175 pounds, and dressed in a white shirt with blue jeans. At 9 a.m. on March 4th, 1963, Lois Ann Jameson returned to Phoenix Police Headquarters. She met Detective Wilfred Young, who had just joined the case. He wanted to show her a lineup of men, including their new suspect. It didn't take Lois long to break down the police's best lead. He wasn't their man. The police pressed, hoping she was mistaken, but Lois remained certain it wasn't him. The disappointed Detective Young realized he needed to hear the victim's story himself, so an exhausted Lois went through it all again. She highlighted the identifying factor of the rope strung across the front seat of the rapist's car. However, her demeanor wasn't convincing to Detective Young, perhaps due to some internal bias or the questionable emergency room report that threw doubt on Lois's story. Young began to wonder if Lois was telling the truth about being assaulted at all. Perhaps the attack was the result of a lover's quarrel. Perhaps she was embarrassed or upset about some secret boyfriend, and this was how she justified it all. A study by criminologist Dr. Jan Jordan zeroed in on this unfortunate social bias. Issues of belief and credibility between police and victims will remain contentious while investigative officers approach rape complaints with particular cultural narratives in mind. If the police had a better informed understanding of the trauma induced by rape, they would recognize that victims engage in minimizing behavior. Jordan also quoted a detective from a 1975 case, 12 years after Lois's traumatic experience. He said, quote, "Women complainants in sexual matters are notorious for embroidery or complete fabrication," end quote. This is the type of institutional bias Lois was now aligned against. Lois was also dealing with a much more specific obstacle to justice. According to Larry A. Van Meter, author of Miranda v. Arizona, The Rights of the Accused by Constitutional Law, Lois had a learning disability that reduced her intellectual capacity to that of a 12 or 13-year-old. This presented a unique challenge to the investigation. Forensic psychology professors Rebecca Milne and Ray Bull address some of these challenges in their study entitled Interviewing Victims of Crime, Including Children and People with Intellectual Disabilities. Their research indicated that investigators who are not accustomed to interviewing victims or witnesses with disabilities may be thrown by the interviewee's apparent discomfort. Skilled detectives rely on reading body language as much as they rely on actual testimony. Detective Young may have misinterpreted Lois's unconventional behavior and believed that she was not telling him the truth about the encounter. Detective Young suggested that Lois take a polygraph test. When she realized they didn't believe her, any trace of confidence vanished. Hopelessness took over. She requested some time to rest. Young granted it, and Lois went home to sleep away her anxiety and trauma, to no avail. Meanwhile, Sergeant Seymour Nealis decided that Young needed some backup on this investigation. He assigned 27-year-old Detective Carol Cooley. Cooley had specifically requested to join Nealis's investigation squad because of the sergeant's reputation for not leaving cases open. He became a detective to solve crimes and bring justice to the people of his city. Cooley first met Lois when he ran the polygraph interview on March 7th. He noticed her nerves right away. When Lois looked at the device, it seemed cold and inhuman. In her heart, she worried it was just going to confirm the police's biases about her misreporting the incident. It seemed like a device that was going to be used to prove that she was crazy and nothing more. Cooley did his best to keep her calm, but her stress only rose as he showed her photos of known sex offenders. None of them looked familiar. None of them were her attacker. She felt like every answer she gave was wrong. Next, Cooley decided to pursue Detective Young's theory that Lois hadn't been attacked and that the encounter was consensual. He zeroed in on Lois's friend from work who rode the bus home with her. Was he more than a friend? Lois denied this, but Cooley pressed further. He told Lois that he understood she was shy and that she was very nervous, but perhaps that's why she had decided to hide the true nature of her relationship with her coworker. Cooley wanted to get to the bottom of the report from the ER that so diverged from Lois's version of the events. He wanted to understand why she hadn't been bruised by these supposed ropes with which her attacker bound her. What he couldn't grasp is that someone could be so terrified they wouldn't try to fight back at all. When the session ended, the sergeant in charge of grading the polygraph tests had dispiriting news for Cooley. The results were useless. Today, the veracity of any polygraph test is suspect, as there is no concrete evidence that the physiological signs measured during these tests actually illustrate deception. In this case, it was not clear whether the polygraph results displayed Lois telling lies or simply Lois's traumatized nerves. Cooley's hard-nosed approach had also done him no favors. He realized that his attitude toward Lois might have affected the test, so he needed to change tactics. He let Lois go home. It was time to dig in and do some real detective work. Cooley dove into the endless logs of past crimes kept at Phoenix PD headquarters, looking for rape cases with a similar MO and location. While he couldn't find any reported rapes or abductions in the area of Marlette Avenue, he did finally reach a breakthrough. Two women had reported that a young Mexican man attempted to rob them. In one case, the man climbed into the woman's car and forced her to drive a certain distance. He told the woman that he was going to rape her, but after handing over some money and pleading with him, the woman managed to convince the man to get out of her car without committing the violent act. Both attacks took place near 2nd Avenue and the Paramount Theater, meaning this suspect might have a hunting ground. Also, it appeared that this rapist was bothered with a guilty conscience. He hadn't been able to go through with his crime in these other two incidents, and after raping Lois, he had asked for her prayers. Cooley believed the same man was involved in all of these attacks. Meanwhile, in the days following her abduction, Lois continued to work. Her brother-in-law, a former Marine, given the pseudonym Paul, accompanied her each night and stood guard outside the theater, taking note of every car that passed by. But he mostly felt powerless. Even after Lois's trauma, she kept working, and the police didn't even believe her. Paul knew that Lois could appear strange or distant to people who didn't know her, but her family knew she would never lie. Not about something like this. There was still a monster out in Phoenix, and he could come back for her whenever he wanted. Then, on the walk home with Lois, he spotted it, an old green car driving across the street from them. But just as quickly as it appeared, it vanished again, back into traffic. Josh turned to Lois, apprehensive. He wondered, should they keep looking for it? He would stay by her side, of course. He didn't want to let this chance get away. Bravely, Lois agreed. Together, they set off to track down this green car that looked so much like the one from March 3rd. As the night sky grew deeper overhead, they ranged out further from the center of town. But Lois persisted. If Josh thought he had a lead, they should follow it. They turned a corner, and there it was. When the driver spotted Paul and Lois again, the car picked up speed and rushed right past them. But it gave Paul enough time to make out the license plate, DFL, followed by three numbers. Paul believed they were 312. Lois confirmed that the car seemed to be the one. Together, they memorized the license plate numbers and rushed home to call the police. Paul met with detectives Cooley and Young the next morning. He brought the information he had found with Lois's help. Cooley wasn't happy about their tactics, but it did put Lois's story in a new light. If this green car had been seen again, it was possible that the stalker was returning to the scene of the crime. Behavior such as this tracked with Cooley's perception of the suspect as someone with a typical hunting ground for victims. He agreed to run the plate numbers. DFL 312 were indeed Arizona plates, belonging to a 1958 Oldsmobile. However, Lois's brother-in-law swore the car they saw the night before was a Packard. This car had a very distinguishing trait. The taillights of a Packard were divided in half by a chrome line. At night, from behind, the Packard appeared to have four taillights instead of just two. And Paul and Lois were certain the green car with the DFL plate had four demonic red lights. It was a Packard. It had to be. Cooley decided to humor them, considering they had cut down a bit of his work for him. He opened a new search now, spread across the entire state of Arizona. He was looking for any car with Arizona plates that began with DFL, as both Paul and Lois were convinced those were the letters on the license plate. An avalanche of reports spread across Cooley and Young's desks. It took some time, but late in the night on March 11th, Cooley had a hit. A 1953 green Packard four-door sedan with license plate DFL 317. It was registered to a Twyla M. Hoffman. Twyla lived at 210 North LeBaron Street in Mesa, right outside of Phoenix. When Cooley presented his findings to Nealis, the sergeant gave the go-ahead. Go check it out. In the morning, Cooley and Young arrived at the small home of Twyla Hoffman and her husband, a man named Ernesto Arturo Miranda. When we return, we'll join Cooley and Young as they track down their only lead in the investigation and finally meet their prime suspect. Now back to the story. On the morning of March 12, 1963, detectives Cooley and Young knocked on the door of 210 North LeBaron Street and waited. But no one came to the door. A neighbor called them over and let them know that the house had been recently vacated. Cooley asked about Twyla, and the detectives learned she was a mother with three kids and a husband named Ernie. This Ernie, Cooley asked, what did the neighbor know about him? The resident shrugged, not much. The family kept to themselves, but he thought Ernie might work for United Produce, a grocery shipment company. Cooley and Young went straight to the United Produce loading docks and found the primary shift manager. Soon enough, they determined that Ernesto Arturo Miranda did indeed work here. He was a fantastic employee, hardworking, dedicated, and reliable. He had such a good reputation, in fact, that the detectives realized the shift manager wouldn't readily implicate Ernie in any wrongdoing. He told them that Ernie had recently moved, but United Produce didn't have his new address yet. Cooley and Young were suspicious of this claim, but it didn't matter. They had what they needed. They went to the local post office the following day and found a change of address on file for Miranda. He and Twyla now lived at 2525 West Mariposa Street. They also combed through Miranda's public records and found a substantial criminal record. His first arrest came at age 15 in 1956, assault with the intent to rape. He was arrested again 2 years later, this time in Los Angeles, for robbery. By 1960, the 19-year-old Miranda had served a year in Tennessee State Prison for robbery. Cooley was convinced. This was their man, and he had almost let him slip away. Cooley and Young drove to the Mariposa address. Sitting in the driveway was that old green Packard, license plate DFL317. Cooley peeked through the backseat window, already knowing what he would find, a thick cord of rope strung across the seat, just as Lois had reported. Twyla came to the door first and woke Ernie up when the officers requested to speak with him. He agreed to be taken for questioning, but it is important to note that he wasn't being arrested. Standard Phoenix police procedure in 1963 stated that if an arrest was made and the suspect was placed into a police cruiser, the suspect should be handcuffed and accompanied in the back seat by another officer. This procedure was not followed when Ernie got into the detective's car. Legally, and from Ernie's own point of view, this wasn't an official detainment. They brought Ernie Miranda into interview room 2 at Phoenix PD. Detective Young informed him that he didn't have to speak with them if he didn't want to, but Ernie claimed to have nothing to hide. They asked him about his whereabouts on the night of March 2nd. Ernie claimed to have been working at United Produce that evening. He said his shift worker and wife would back him up. That wasn't enough for Cooley and Young to buy, especially after meeting his manager at work. They knew that Ernie had some people willing to protect him. So Cooley made the call. They needed Lois Ann Jameson. She returned to the police station, validated, but still frightened. Cooley placed Ernie in a lineup behind a two-way mirror. Lois stepped into the viewing room, feet away from the man who might have raped her. She pointed to Ernie as the most likely candidate, but, she admitted, she couldn't be completely sure. It was dark that night. It looked like him, but she couldn't confirm it for the detective. But Cooley wasn't going to give up. Now he was on Lois's side, and he was sure this was her attacker. It was just a gut feeling, but he was certain that Ernie was the guy, and this detective wasn't going to let this opportunity pass. Cooley sat back down across from Ernie in interview room 2. He let the moment hang in the air. Ernie asked how the lineup went. Cooley said it didn't go well, not for Ernie. Ernie sighed and asked, "So they ID'd me?" coolly nodded. They're pretty sure, Ernie. And with that, Ernie broke, saying that he best tell the truth now. Cooley agreed. He asked him, just after midnight, March 3rd, on Marlette Avenue, what happened. And then Ernesto Miranda confessed. Cooley took down a detailed account of Ernie's night. He admitted to following Lois home, to the kidnapping, and to the rape. He also copped to the two other reports of attempted robbery and rape that Cooley had found in the Phoenix PD system while conducting this investigation. After a week of dead ends and wrong turns, the case against Ernie Miranda came together in less than a day. It was almost too easy. Cooley typed up a template for a written statement. He asked Ernie to fill in the blank spaces with his own description of the events, the confession he had just related. Ernie agreed. In crooked lines, full of misspellings, Ernie bared his soul and admitted to his crimes as a rapist and thief. Cooley completed the rest of the document. It read, March 13, 1963, 1:30 p.m., rape DR number 63-08380. Below the official log information, Miranda signed the following statement. Quote, I, Ernesto Miranda, do hereby swear that I make this statement voluntarily and of my own free will, with no threats, coercion, or promises of immunity, and with full knowledge of my legal rights, understanding any statement I make may be used against me, end quote. And with that, Cooley filed the report into the system. Logged and completed, he had apprehended Ernesto Miranda, and according to standard practice at the time, he had followed the legal procedure. Cooley was finally able to put Ernie in handcuffs, arresting him for the rape and robbery of Lois Ann Jameson, as well as the attempted robbery of another young Phoenix-area woman on November 27, 1962. Cooley was convinced the trial would be open and shut. In some sense, he wasn't wrong, at least at first. But Ernie's legal counsel would zero in on one particular factor of the investigation. At no point had Ernie been directly offered legal counsel, up to and after the point of him making his written confession. It would be argued that Ernie Miranda's constitutional rights had been violated during his trip to Phoenix PD. As the case grew in national prominence, it reached a point where a technicality in the law might set this admitted rapist free. The question became, is that really justice? Is the standard of law more important, even in a case where a suspect seems clearly guilty? The trials of Ernie Miranda would throw the entire concept of innocent and guilty in an existential tailspin, a spiral that would lead all the way to the Supreme Court. Thanks for listening to Not Guilty. We'll be back Thursday with our next episode on Ernesto Arturo Miranda. We'll cover his initial trial and then follow the legal maneuvering that brought his case before the highest court in the country. You can find more episodes of Not Guilty, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or your favorite podcast directory. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoyed the show, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. In the meantime, based on the evidence presented, decide for yourself, were Ernesto Miranda's rights truly violated by the detectives of Phoenix PD? Or was this important and significant legal precedent developed in a desperate attempt to let a known criminal go free? Find out next week. Not Guilty was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Not Guilty is written by Jack Bentel. I'm Vanessa Richardson.